the scheme of redemption, the fullness of the age, it carries into what becomes the last days, Hebrews 1, 1 and following. We are in the last days. We're in the fullness of time. There isn't another worldly, earthly time that we're awaiting, like the premillennialist or someone else might suggest. This is the fullness of time. Jesus came, born of a virgin, just as God said would happen in the Old Testament, and it's clearly being manifested now right before our eyes. One of the things that you might try to do as you study the Bible is try to put yourself in a first century perspective for context. You can't do that in reality, but when you're reading the Bible, try to consider what it was like to be a Jew in the first century, having the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures and all the prophecies, and here's Jesus right before your eyes, and you're trying to wrap your mind around this and decide whether or not this is true. This is who the Old Testament said was coming. Okay, after the cross and redemption secured at Calvary, post-Pentecost, the apostles are preaching. The apostle Paul writes the book of Galatians to the churches of Galatia, a plurality of churches. And he writes to all these churches and says, in the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son. There's no mistake about this. It was in the right time. God is an interesting God from the standpoint of time, because God, when it comes to time, is God, the eternal God, is He subject to time? Nope. He transcends time, doesn't He? But you and I are subject to time. And the Bible says to redeem the time, for the days are shortened and are evil. There are various principles that we're given in regard to what we're supposed to do in management of time, being good stewards, because we are not able to transcend time yet. Now, what happens when you draw your last breath in this physical body and your spirit returns back to the God who created it in paradise? What happens then? Well, then you're not subject to time as we know it. The Bible says God, again, is not subject to time, but in the fullness of time, as it relates to all things material and sin and salvation, God sent forth His Son. When did that happen? It happened during the days of the Romans, the empire. So I want to remind you geographically what God is setting up, what He has been setting up since the dawn of creation. You remember the Bible says that the scheme of redemption, was it something God just conceived once when man sinned? Oh, I got to come up with an idea to get man out of this terrible condition. Tell me more about the plan of redemption. When did it exist in the mind of God? That's right. Paul writes in Ephesians chapter 1 about verse 4, before the foundations of the world, God had this in His mind. Someone argues with that and says, well, that just don't make any sense. Why would God even create a world? Don't go there. Because you exist, don't you? How are you going to get out of here without Christ? You're not. Not in a good way. So we need to remember that. So we don't want to argue with God and argue with the plan of redemption in the fullness of time. So here we are in the first century. This is a map of Israel in the New Testament era. Not much here. Just kind of pointing out, catching us up to date. I think the roads are interesting that are pointed out. The dotted lines represent your Roman roads and well-established routes and travel ways. The King's Highway would have been over here as it always had been. But now, again, a fortified, protected highway by the Romans. Travel was flourishing during this day and age. Economy was flourishing. Wealth. And yet, something else was also flourishing during this day and age. If you weren't a part of a sovereign nation or a nation from the standpoint that Rome allowed you to exist, For example, Judea. Did you know that Judea was allowed to exist by the Romans? And if you were a part of that, a Jewish individual, you were allowed to exist under Roman rule in Judea. This guy named King Herod, or Herod the Great, or Herod the Terrible, depending upon how you classify him, he had a lot to do with the establishment of a sense of rule in Judea. Before this period of time, though, the Jews were in constant revolt before Christ was ever conceived by a virgin, by the Holy Spirit. There was quite the revolt and insurrection, if you will, rebellion by the Jews in this land that had been allowed to come back since the days of Ezra and Nehemiah under the Persians or the under Cyrus and what was really becoming the Grecians and then the Romans. Having been reestablished, they were never really in submission to the Romans until King Herod. King Herod comes in, and he is an Idumean, likely born sometime around 73 B.C. Idumean, related to the Edomites, who had, remember, had crossed with the Ishmaelites. And this Herod was, he was a friend of various Roman leaders like Mark Antony. He was established in the Roman culture. There's a reason why the Romans, as we've talked about geographically, were interested in this land. Before I say, why would the Romans, a dominating empire, be interested in this land and trying to find someone that they can work with to help settle this land and frame peace? Why would the Romans be interested in this land so much? It's the middle, it's the heartbeat of the known world at the day and age. Sure, you by now got a lot of traveling through the Mediterranean, but even the Mediterranean can be pretty rough at times. And so you've got your dependable travel routes through this land, like Mike's saying, you got Egypt down here, you've got again Greece and in Rome way up here, and Fertile Crescent on down here, and it's a pretty important piece of property, isn't it? So, they were very concerned for this, and Josephus writes and says that in the year of the consulship of Calvinus and Pollio, about 40 B.C., they were really trying to get this and form an alliance in this land and settle the Jews down. Herod, who had joined himself up with Mark Antony and all these big name people you've probably heard of, he goes back to Judea to win the kingdom from another guy's name I can't say very well without thinking very hard about it. He goes back around 40 B.C. to try to settle this land. Now, this is still 35 or more years before Jesus is born. Remember, in the fullness of time. Alright, here's an interesting point of view. According to Josephus, Herod finally settled the land, and he did so by converting to Judaism. Around 37 B.C., 34 to 37 B.C., he concocts the idea and says, guess what? I'll convert to Judaism. I'm related to them. I'll become a proselyte. And that's a part of the reason and how he becomes King Herod, if you will. And you have this dynastic Herodian dynasty. He has several sons, Herod Antipas, Herod Archelaus, and various ones that you read about in the book of Acts, the one that's eaten up by worms. That's one of his sons, who becomes more or less of a governor, because after King Herod dies, this king here that builds the Herodian temple complex, we'll talk about that a little bit more again, All of this leads to the destruction of Jerusalem, by the way. Historically, geographically, which again sets the stage for the dispersion from around Jerusalem, and the gospel really takes off into the known world because of a geographical issue, Bible geography. So what's interesting is here again how all this develops by the time we get to the New Testament. And you may have heard of individuals that were still to this day heroes. You can read about them in the Apocrypha, so-called scriptures by the Roman Catholics. They are historical documents, but they are not inspired. And you can read about these guys that led revolts and warred against the Romans during this day and age. But what's interesting to me is that Judea was not really settled, if you will, until about 35 or 34 B.C. by this King Herod, Herod the Great, or Herod the Terrible to the Jews. The Pharisees despised him. I believe the Sadducees were somewhat allied with him, as the Sadducees were somewhat allied with the Romans. Sadducees, as you've read about, were very politically minded. They were very materially minded. And yet the Pharisees did not like, and Pharisees and scribes despised King Herod. And why would they despise King Herod? Just think about it. What they themselves were guilty of, Jesus says in Matthew 23, they themselves were quick to judge everyone else as hypocrites. And it's just a cycle of the same stuff we deal with today. Who's right or wrong in politics today? Republicans, Democrats, they're all playing cards that are often on the hypocrisy side. You know, and it's all about money and secular things and politics, and it has nothing to do with what's right and truthful and absolute. So again, I'm getting a little bit bogged down. This is an outline of the Roman Empire during the days of the New Testament. I mean, the civilized world did not exist historically outside of these parameters during this day and age. And so if you can see that red line that kind of encompasses the known world is Italy. You got Spain and France up here. Out here would have been Britannia, or what is now Great Britain, England. And they were becoming settled. But up in here is what's always been interesting from a historical standpoint. The Germans, up in here the Germans, the Germanic people, the Babblers, or the barbarians in the Bible. The Romans had a time. They could not settle those barbarians, those Germanic people. They fought with them. They'd get so stretched out and so thinned out with their lines of battle and warring that they would often lose their resources, and they had a hard time. So again, when you think about the known world, what we're talking about is the known civilized world, historical world. The world that was writing, the world that was documenting. And this line here, the Roman Empire, represents that civilized world of this day and age in the New Testament. It doesn't mean there weren't other people spread out. There were other people. They weren't very civilized. They were called babblers because guess what? Their language wasn't very refined. They didn't record very much. And we don't have a whole lot to go on. And they weren't really a threat to the bigger picture. Again, I think we sometimes miss that point when we talk about the Roman Empire and we think that's the only existing people. No, there were people that existed. They had just wandered off. They were vagabonds. There were people that just didn't, it's like the people that lived down in Terlingua, Texas. Anyway, just a segue of thought. People want to get away from any kind of sense of rule and just live like a bunch of animals. But anyway, so the Romans brought about a major sense of civility in the known world. The main point we must see here is this. When you get to the Great Commission in Matthew 28 and Mark 16, Luke 24, and Jesus says, you go to this little town right here called Jerusalem, and you wait and you tarry for the promise of the Holy Spirit. Because when He comes upon you, He is going to guide you into all truth. And it's in this context of thought that Jesus also says You, from this little point right here, you stay and you tarry, and from this little point, you go and you preach the gospel to the entire world. And you go and preach the gospel when you receive it to every creature. Now, how many creatures from different nations and cultures existed all throughout this known world? All right, another thing to think about, too, is when that Great Commission was given by Jesus Christ, in a very civilized world for the most part, Jesus left them with no excuse. He says, you can travel. He'll tell them through the inspired writers, be civil. The rulers that be are set up, ordained by God. Doesn't mean he approves of everything. Certainly not the immorality and all the things that went on. But for the most part, you live in a civilized world. You're going to be able to travel. You go and you preach that gospel. In the fullness of time, God set this thing up. God was in control from the very beginning. And so geographically speaking, as we develop, we have to see that in the Roman Empire. Yes, ma'am. Well, that was like English today. It was the accepted known language, but not everybody did speak it. Yes. It was the very common language. The Koine Greek was what Ginger was asking. It was the language that the Romans were establishing. It was called, not Pax Romana, it was, what's it called? Hellenism. 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 Everybody ever heard of that? What is Hellenism? That was the Romans' mission. To Hellenize the whole world meant to do what? To get them the Greek language, Koine Greek, to Hellenize them, to culture them, to civilize them. Under what kind of civilization? Roman civilization, Roman rule. They would set up, just like we today, flags or some type of an icon that symbolized Roman pride. How do we do this today as American citizens? We like to fly our flags, don't we? You know, I love American baseball. What do we sing at the seventh inning stretch? God bless America. You know, I love that sport because it's an American sport, but because it really is connected to a nation that did originally have this idea, this theme of in God we trust, the God of the Bible. And I like that. So from that standpoint, I'm okay. I like the fact that we are Americans, but how many people in this world have just plumb gone crazy? You know, it's a slippery slope because you're trying to intermingle secular things with spiritual things. So what do I continually teach and tell myself even during this day? What did they have to say? You can be a Roman citizen. Paul appealed to Rome, didn't he? He said, I appeal to Caesar. He appealed to the Roman law. But Paul, above all, was what? He was a Christian at that time. And when he gets to Rome, guess what he does? Taking advantage of every Roman civil law and rule, what does the Bible say in Acts 28? He had the opportunity to preach and teach the gospel to who? Yeah, that's right. Who said Caesar? It doesn't matter, but you said Caesar? That's right. Caesar's court. Someone in Caesar's household heard the gospel. So most people don't see the opportunity, it seems to me. Most people see the terrible and pessimistic things. I can't do anything in this world. And God said during this day and age, you get out there and you preach the gospel because you live in, for the most part, a civilized world. How about today? When I look at Roman geography and the history of the day and age, I think about how awesome it is that God set this up in the fullness of time. The world's never been the same. And so we pointed out some things that we're still impacted by because of the Roman culture. We're still living with Roman architecture. I drive by and see some of the houses people built, and some people still marvel at what? The columns and the types of structures and the arches that the Romans invented. And they want to build houses. Because why? It's neat. It looks cool. Look at your buildings where the governors and the senators and congressmen, we're looking where they hang out. Oftentimes they're modeled after what? We're not building pyramids anymore, for the most part. We build buildings and structures that kind of remind us of something very regal and very royal from the standpoint of a Romanesque type of mindset. So again, this is an interesting picture here, or a showing. This actually stretches out to 117 A.D. It starts about 200 B.C. 200 B.C. What that means is the darker shades here of red were the established Roman Empire going back to about 211 or 210 B.C. Now, what does that say about, again, time? As far as what was going on during the time of the 200 B.C. era. Here's a trivia question. Which book in the Bible was written between 400 B.C. and, say, about 34, 5, 6 A.D.? Anybody know? Between 400 B.C. approximately and about 37 A.D., which book in your inspired Bible was written during that time? Anybody know? Zero. It's a period of darkness, a period of silence. After Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Malachi, God shuts inspiration off as far as written inspiration. And we go silent. We go silent as far as inspired books of the Bible. Now, during that time, what's interesting is there are a lot of recorded books and various things that are, biblical, referring to biblical things and biblical concepts are called the Apocrypha books, which means spurious. There's contradictions in them. The Catholics include them in their Bible, like Esther and Tobit or Tobith, various books, you've probably seen them. There's some interesting historical data in there. But when it comes to inspiration, God was silent. And he told the prophets, he told Amos, there's going to be a period of silence. And there was. He didn't talk. He didn't inspire anybody to write. And so what's going on during this day and age? It's about 200 or so B.C., 200 years before Christ. Starts to spread out. Roman Empire, dominance starting to spread out. It's kind of interesting to me how it takes off down here around the northern parts of Egypt. And they get really established in this area. But these purple areas and this yellow area isn't really till the latter parts of 100, 150, 200 A.D. So it takes about a 400-year period of time for Rome to really get established. And then guess what happens rapidly after about 200 A.D. with regard to the Roman Empire? Can they get along very well? I'm going to make an observation. You know, again, I love to read history and stuff when I have the time, and it's enjoyable to me. But brethren, I'm telling you, the gospel of Jesus Christ was tearing the world up. It was tearing the consciences of men up. It was affecting the world like no other message, because there wasn't a message as pure and clear ever before, revealed, preached, written, and distributed until this day and age. I don't think we understand how powerful the gospel is. Perhaps the world has gotten so used to the gospel and the commonplace of it in this country that we've decided, well, it's done all it can do. You believe that? I don't. Just got to get busy. So let's talk about something else. All right. I want to incorporate in this study the temple, because this is important. Because what does the temple in Jerusalem, which was the tabernacle, remember in the book of Exodus? It was a tabernacle that could travel, a tent. And that tent becomes the temple in Jerusalem that God chooses. And so around, this says 1250 B.C., Moses receives, this is a timeline that may be disputed, I'm going to say probably around 1450 B.C., but this is an interesting just graph. Moses receives instruction, the building of the tabernacle. It's about 1000 B.C. I agree with this right here. King David captures Jerusalem. Again, the tabernacle was a traveling structure. Remember the details and the ornate development and design given in the book of Exodus? What an interesting, you may be bored to read that. And when I was a kid, I was like, well, I don't care about these boards and all this stuff. But as you get older, you might go back and just read that and go, that's pretty interesting the way God designed that ornate tent to be the representation of His person inside this Holy of Holies in the back here by an Ark of the Covenant with angels, cherubims, that represented the seat of mercy. And what's the seat of mercy? What those Jews forget? That God was a merciful God. If they would just be humble. How do you explain characters throughout the Old Testament like David and others who made terrible mistakes but become and are a man after God's own heart? They suffered from the consequences of their own sin. But how do you understand their character? Seat of mercy. God was a merciful God and He desired to be merciful. And what did David do when he sinned? He repented. I love the story, the parable of the lamb and so forth that Nathan the prophet comes and tells David. And David's sitting there listening to that story. You can just almost see him gritting his teeth and going, well, whoever did that deserves it to be. Let me have him. And Nathan says, thou art the man. And then David says, ooh, you got me. But what does David do? What does David do at the birth of Bathsheba's baby that dies? He was told to die. He doesn't shake his fist at God and get mad. He goes and says, sackcloth and ash and mourning. Says, I can't bring him back, but I'll go to him. You talk about a man that understood mercy, that was David. But a man that made a lot of mistakes too, right? Again, the temple, this would be your first temple complex built, 968 B.C. is probably a close time frame. And there's a drawing, a rendition of a simple structure, Solomon's temple. And I want you to notice here, I thought this was interesting just to compare time. You know, you're talking about how many years, 930 B.C. and the kingdom splits. Question. How long was Solomon's temple a very effective piece of unity in the kingdom as a whole? That material structure with the Ark of the Covenant, how long did it exist and stand as a point of unity? I want you to think about that. Because what always unites us is not the physical. It's the spiritual. It's the eternal. And there was always some things about this, and the Hebrews writer says this. I don't have to make this up. That this thing right here was temporary. The blood of bulls and goats could never take away the sins of mankind. And people misunderstood and misunderstood the God of the Bible and the temple's purpose and so forth. So this temple becomes quite the distraction throughout time. Over time, this time develops here. You've got the Assyrians will come in around this 700 period and take the northern kingdom, and they're gone. First temple period will end sometime around Jeremiah, Ezekiel, around 600 B.C. The destruction of Solomon's temple takes place around 586 B.C. by Nebuchadnezzar, bringing us back to the book of Daniel. Destroyed. It's not the first time or the last time this thing will suffer. You have this period of time, late 6th period, when Cyrus, during the Persian rule, Malachi's prophecy, Ezra and Nehemiah come back, they build some walls back around, and they get this temple put back together somewhat. Zerubbabel's construction, a reconstruction, take sometime around 515 B.C., 500 years or so before Christ. This thing won't last. Herod, this is where King Herod comes back into the picture. A lot of people hate Herod, but one of the things about Herod that is amazing is what he does as far as architecture is concerned. Now, again, I'm not that smart to remember all this verbatim, so I'm going to read you what I've got. What made him so popular, and this is a quote, the history of his legacy has polarized opinion. Polarized opinion. as he is known for his colossal building projects throughout Judea, including his expansion of the second temple in Jerusalem. How to win favor with the Jews and civilize this area of the world? What we'll do is we'll take Zerubbabel's temple, that reconstruction, and we'll expand it and make it into something the world has never seen and the world will marvel over, and these Jews will be so proud of. You remember, look at Matthew 24. Look at Matthew 24. Look at verse 1. And Jesus is close to the cross. He's close to his arrest and betrayal by Judas Iscariot. And look at what Matthew 24, verse 1 says. Jesus had just rebuked those scribes and Pharisees and called them a bunch of hypocrites in chapter 23. This pretty much set the course for his arrest. Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. You see that phrase, buildings of the temple? That's a reference to the Herodian temple complex. All the marvelous buildings of the temple. Let me show you another picture. This may put a little bit perspective. This is a rendition, archaeological, you know, you take and you line it out, of the Herodian temple complex. You've heard of the court of the Gentiles? In the book of Acts, the Gentiles were allowed to come inside here. But who was allowed only to come inside here? The Jews. This is the Herodian temple complex. You see how wide he broadened it and expanded it? You see the columns and so forth? There would be columns and arches, again, after a Roman architectural concept and principle. Setting, again, a little bit more of a drawing, I want you to notice how large this is. This right here represents the original wall that surrounded the temple. The original Solomonic temple, Zerubbabel's reconstruction. Again, Herod took and expanded this thing and grew it on out. This is a little bit more of a drawing. This is likely what the apostles or disciples here are pointing out. They're walking out of this temple complex. He, by the way, in Matthew 23, he just preached this message inside that temple complex and said, "You scribes and you Pharisees, hypocrites." And laid into them. Jesus didn't preach this message way out here in the middle of nowhere where nobody could hear him. He preached it right in the center of attention. When he scourged the temple, you remember the stories about him going in and with a whip scourging these people, the money exchange and so forth? That's inside here. He'd come inside one of these doorways right here. There'd be people selling the animals and all that stuff. He takes a whip out and starts whipping and scourging and turning over tables, turning them. And you've turned my father's house into a house of what? Robbers, thieves, a den of thieves and robbers. That's right. So he's inside this thing. When he departs, he comes out these gates. This is the Herodian temple complex. Now, what's interesting to me in contrast, look at that. What is that a picture of today? You see the some of the walls and the ancient outlying of this? That's some of the original, just the especially down here, the retaining part. Now, all this stuff was likely reconstructed in during the days of the Turks and so forth. Turks came in and rebuilt this, and they took over the Muslims. You're right. And Dome of the Rock, guess where it sits? Guess where the original temple, Herodian temple, guess where it sat? Right there. See the old arches and stuff? Some people say that's some of the stuff still standing on the outskirts of the original walls, the outline, you know, of where the original was. But yes, that's correct. I've got a picture here, I think, giving me east, north, south, east, and west. Okay, this is a different angle here. Here again, the Western or Wailing Wall, you've seen those pictures of these long-haired, bearded Jewish guys with tassels and so forth sitting there wailing and inserting little prayers and stuff on the outside, not on the inside, on the outside of this wall. This is where they go. That's one of the old original. Again, this retaining wall, it's hard to see in this picture. You know how big that footer is right there? Now, you go back again 2,000 years plus, and keep in mind that they had to come in here and cut and level all this out and put those rocks right in place and set it. There's your cornerstone. And build that corner to support this massive, you know, structure. Yes, these are just pictures again showing the modern day presentation. There you go. That kind of lays it out for you. There's the dome on the rock right in the center, and then this right here shows you where the original temple was set and the original walls and so forth. Now, I want you to see that because, again, from a geographical New Testament standpoint, how much of a distraction was this temple, this structure, to Christianity in the first century, to Judaism, to Jews in the first century? How much of a distraction was this? Let's look at a couple passages. Look at a couple passages in the Old Testament for me and with me, and let's look at this. Look at 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 8. Of course, the temple is built in 1 Kings chapter 7, chapter 8. But look at chapter 9, verse 8. Even during the first temple, Solomon's temple, look at 1 Kings 9, verse 8. And listen to this passage. Back then, before the Romans, before Nebuchadnezzar ever got a hold of it, and he does get a hold of it, but look at 1 Kings 9, verse 8. Well, you look at verse 7. Then will I cut off Israel out of the land which I have given them, and this house which I have hallowed for my name will I cast out of my sight, and Israel shall be a proverb and a byword among all people. And at this house which is high, everyone that passeth by it shall be astonished and shall hiss, and they shall say, why hath the Lord done thus unto the land, this land, and to this house? I want you to see that passage before we go any further, and we'll stop on this. That's during Solomon's day. What did God just tell Solomon? This house, in one sense, really means nothing. It'll be destroyed, and it'll be a laughingstock. People will be walking by, hissing is the old archaic word. Jeremiah's weeping, because, and he says in Lamentation, how can this massive thing be completely destroyed and leveled, and the people are walking by laughing? Jeremiah records this very thing happening. What does that teach? What should it teach the people of God during that day and age? Remember that, and we'll talk more about that Sunday morning, Lord willing. I appreciate your time and attention. I hope I didn't get too bogged down. We've got to stop.